There we go. Recording in progress. Okay, so here we go. So, from Jerome. I used to live on Jerome Court. In some traditions, it is said that you choose your own parents before you are born. On a spiritual level, this idea of pre-birth choice raises all kinds of questions. Yes, it does. For instance, is this part of a lucid volitional experience of death? Who exactly is making the choice, and how is the choice presented, and by whom? I love these questions. These are awesome. Yeah, so really, Jerome, it depends on who you talk to and who you ask. It's all over the map here. Some traditions, and I've heard them say, yes, you do have a choice. I don't think so. And let me tell you, this is also in resonance with Buddhist and Hindu teachings, and it just makes so much sense to me. So instead of just being a dilettante and talking about what other traditions talk about, which I'm not qualified to do, I can tell you what I think, and I can tell you what the Buddhists and Hindus seem to resonate with here as well. You don't have a choice. In the sense, this is really actually very interesting. You don't have a choice tonight. So if you want to know how you're going to be reborn, look at your experience tonight. The tradition is replete with this. You want to know how you're going to die, what your experience is going to be like in the Bardos, look at your experience at tonight's dream. In fact, the Bardos are called the dream at the end of time. And so this makes so much sense to me that if you are not aware in the dream, if you're not lucid in the dream, and therefore can make choices, that's a great reason for engaging in lucid dreaming, dream yoga. And a big reason why dream yoga in particular came about as a way to prepare for death. So dream yoga came about specifically to deal with your question. So think about it. You're going to sleep tonight. You don't become lucid. Who makes the choices in your dreams? You don't. Your habits do. Your karma does. So it's like the famous question. I always ping this out when Trungpa Rinpoche was asked, what is it that reincarnates your bad habits? So this makes a lot of sense to me. If you don't wake up and take control of your dream now or in the Bardo, what decides for you, what chooses for you? You don't. Your habits do. Your karma does. And to take this into a really kind of practical arena, your habits are deciding for you now. I mean, literally, what's the stat? Over 95% of what we do is really dictated by unconscious processes. You think you're making your choices now? You think you have free will now? Yet. Not really. Yeah, I mean, we could debate the whole free will thing. That's a little bit outside the scope of what we're asking here. But to me, I just say, look at your life now and realize how much of your life now. You're taking rebirth right now, Jerome, moment to moment to moment. You're going through the Bardos right now. What's dictating your rebirth now if you're not mindful, aware, lucid to what's happening now? Your bad habits, your habits, karma, that's what decides for you. So I actually don't, again, I'll put my foot down here. I don't agree that you have a choice after death, unless you're lucid. If you're lucid, that's a game changer. That's when you can, and the great masters, His Holiness Karmapa Dalai Lama and the great ones, they have utter, complete control, utter choice. For one reason, because they have no unconscious mind, so there's no karma or bad habits to buffet them around. Plus, they never lose consciousness. They're completely lucid through the whole thing, so they can control the whole shebang. Who exactly is making the choice? You aren't. Your karma. How is the choice presented? It's presented just by the release of your karmic propensities within the Bardo arena. So that's a little bit trickier question. How is the choice presented? It's presented is in the same way that choice is presented in your phenomenal reality right now. It's dictated by the arising from, in this case, collective group karma. In the Bardo, it's the choice is presented. Again, you don't have a choice, but the environment is presented even by habits itself. Who is making the choice? Yeah, that's a really, really big question. Again, habits making the choice. If you're lucid, who's making the choice? Rigpa, nature, mind. Okay? All right, that's a good one. Thanks, Jerome. If you're on and you want to say something else, feel free to come on. I don't see any. Okay. All right, from Joe. Are all mantras a method of, I'm going to answer some of these as we go along because there's a number of questions here and it's hard to keep them all together. Are all mantras a method for karmic purification? Yes, it depends on how you define that, because somewhat related to the other question, mantra meaning literally mind protector. In this regard, what mantras do, connected to the earlier question, is they literally protect your mind from involuntary rebirth. The mind is always taking involuntary shape now. Just look at the discursive levels of commentary in your mind. There's always layer upon layer upon layer of unconscious, subconscious gossip. That's your karma. That's your habit running in the background all the time. And so your mind is taking rebirth moment to moment to moment in the form of those loop discursive patterns you're thinking. Mantras protect you from that. They voluntarily shape your mind. That's what mantras do. It's a type of voluntary rebirth practice, literally. And they're a method of karma purification because they prevent the accumulation of karma, right? So I'll say more to that in a second. So if so, is the type of purification specific to the deity mantra? Mostly, yes. This is such a big topic. So if you're looking, again, I struggle a little bit just because there's so much covered here. There are very specific mantras like Vajrasattva, right? Om Vajrasattva Hum is the short version of it. The 100 syllable Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manivalaya Vajrasattva Devanabhatista, 100 mantras, which I recited 120,000 times. So I know that one pretty well. That's a very specific purification mantra that is generic to cleaning up all karma. In addition to that, then particular specific mantras associated with specific archetypal deities are in fact designed to purify particular involuntary forms of habit. So there are specific mantras that are designed to purify specific kind of habit patterns for sure, that are associated with the deity. Absolutely. For example, is there a specific deity, a mantra for an addiction? No, not really. Depends on how you define addiction. So again, this terminology was not used when mantras were created, and you can't just lily-nilly just create your own mantra, right? You have to have be at least the level of the eighth bhumi, really high level of realization when you can hack into the vibratory codes of reality and bring these sonic codes basically into common domain. So it's not like very, very few people have the power, the capacity to actually upload a mantra. So a mantra is when they were devised, the term addiction wasn't used in the way we're using it now. But if you think of addiction in the sense, in a larger multivalent archetypal sense, that we're all fundamentally addicted to our habits, we're all addicted to form, we're addicted to thought, we're addicted to all these behavior patterns, then using that larger definition of addiction, there are specific deities and mantras for addictions, depending on what you're addicted to. So if you want to purify, here's just a couple of quick examples. If you want to purify your addiction to anger, you recite Akshobhya's mantra. If you want to purify your addiction to passion, you recite Amitabha's mantra. If you want to purify your addiction to jealousy, you recite Amoghasiddhi's mantra. If you want to purify your addiction to pride, you recite Ratnasambhava's mantra, ad infinitum. And so that's one reason there are, in fact, so many deities and so many mantras, because there's so many different ways that habit patterns can be created and therefore purified. Part two, three questions here. Many of us receive empowerments in Tibet, that's for sure, and do not understand and did not understand what vows we are taking because they were in Tibetan. I love this because this is so spot on and they were not explained to us. Oh yeah, I chuckle because I've been through dozens of these. I have no idea what they're doing. I do now, but I didn't then. How do we know if we broke the vows, Samaya? They're called the tantric vows are called Samaya vows. And so there's three, brief interjection here. There are three classic formulations of vows, the Hinayana vows, the Mahayana vows, Bodhicitta vows, Bodhisattva vows. And then the tantric vows, which are these samaya vows. And I'll say more about that in a second. How do we know if we broke the vows and how to repair the broken vows? Do we need to worry about that? I was told by a translator that we would never agree to the vows if we knew what we are agreeing to. Oh, that's hysterical. It's that, like you said, LOL, totally an LOL. Well, here's the deal, Joe. This is, again, when you go to an abhisheka, an empowerment, or in Tibetan, wang, there are many ways to receive the empowerment. If you're going in just to do, and again, this does not mean just in the pejorative limited sense. If you're attending an empowerment as a blessing empowerment, this is, anybody can do this. For instance, you go to a massive four-day Kalachakra empowerment that someone like His Holiness the Dalai Lama does. There are no samaya commitments associated with a blessing empowerment. So you're not violating anything. If you go in, however, with the intent that, hey, I want to do the Kalachakra sadhana, I want to recite the Kalachakra mantra, I want to do the Kalachakra visualization, that's a different story. Then, yes, then you need to know what you're doing, because then you actually do take on samaya vows, samaya commitments, and you really want to know what you're doing. So it really depends on the level of empowerment that you're receiving. Blessing empowerment, you don't have to worry about this. A full-blown tantric empowerment to do a sadhana, that's a whole different story. Then you have to be aware of the samaya stuff. And there are 14 root samaya vows and then a whole subsidiary list of secondary vows. You kind of need to know about those because otherwise you're getting married. You're getting married to the deity and you don't really know the marriage requirements, right? You don't know what the significant other, in this case, the other is very significant, right? You don't really know what the significant other is really asking of you. So in those cases, you want to dot your I's, cross your T's, get your spiritual attorney and make sure you know what you're doing. So I'm going to leave it at that unless you're here and want to come on. Because if you didn't take this with a specific sadhana in mind, and based on the question, it sounds like you didn't. In my training, you don't have anything to worry about. A mantra is said silently as powerful as those said out loud. This is the third part of this person's question, third series. I feel a stronger energy, perhaps deity presence, the more I whisper or say the mantra silently. Maybe because the sound doesn't overwhelm the energy feeling. Okay. Mantras said silently are really just as powerful as those said out loud. There's three, you know, there's many ways to recite mantra. Full blown auditory, like me, you know, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. Then you do a whispered recitation. Then you do what's called a Vajra recitation, or silent, you recite it in your mind. They all have the equivalent power. However, one little asterisk here. There is a little bit to be said. Karma takes on more impact when it goes from mental to verbal to physical. And so I'll let you sort out if that means mantras have more efficacy, efficiency when they're recited out loud. My training says no, but there is something about reciting things vocally that does add a little bit more karmic oomph when you go from purely mental to verbal to physical. Okay. All right. Then you said some nice things about me. I don't need to repeat those, but thank you for those nice words. Okay, from Kunzang. And again, if the people are here and want to follow up, just raise your hand. Kunzang, how to begin exploring the dream yoga path? Is there a beginner category on nightclub site? What about books, etc.? Yeah, we have a lot. There's a lot, Kunzang. So if you're a member of nightclub, we've got a ton. Oh my God, you know, like 300 hours of stuff. What I would do there, if you are a nightclub site member, go all the way back to the very beginning of the webinar series that we started almost 3 years ago. There's like 60 of the webinars. They've kind of tapered off quite a bit because honestly, other things are taking precedence. And, you know, I've said almost everything, but well, that's actually not true. I've said the most important things to get people up and running in these, I don't know how many webinars we've done by now. But Kunzang, if you're interested, I would start with the first ones because I do a pretty rigorous systematic presentation all the way through. That's one way. Second thing, in terms of books, I've written 3 books on these. Probably the most entry-level user-friendly one is the book I published last year with Harbinger Press. Where do I have it? Oh, here it is. This gives me a chance to put up my lemonade stand, right? So the Lucid Dreaming Workbook, a step-by-step guide to mastering your dream life. There you go. And maybe Alyssa can put that in the chat column. This, I had fun with this. This is a you know, workbook type thing where you fill in and you do the little exercises, and the people that have gone through it have got derived some benefit. And so I recommend you start with this, because there is a series of progressive practices here. To really do dream yoga effectively really helps to have a strong foundation in lucid dreaming. Once you get your feet underneath that a little bit, Kunsang, then this is the book we're discussing in the nightclub book study group thing. This is my second book, Dream Yoga, Illuminating Your Life, to Lucid Dreaming and the Tibetan Yogas of Sleep. I cover a ton of material here, right? And then honestly, Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche, I mean, you know, I'm interviewing him on Tuesday. His second edition of his beautiful, beautiful book, The Tibetan Yogas of Dream and Sleep, fantastic. And then outside of that, oh my gosh, there's so much here, my friend. Start checking out all the different interviews on the nightclub site, all the podcasts that we did, starting with like how many of them, right? Very specific ones with Daniel Love, Robert Wagner, several with Charlie Morley, Stephen LaBerge. I mean, there's, I don't know how many, 20 of these interviews. And these are really great because almost with every one of my guests, I ask them, what's your go-to induction method? What, you know, these kinds of things. So that's probably enough, Kunsang, to get you going for quite a while. Other really great books, my dear friend Stephen LaBerge, his books, especially Exploring the World of Lucid Dreaming. I'd read that one first. And then his first book is Lucid Dreaming Proper. These are classics. That'll keep you going for a while. And all in both books, I have a fair amount of suggested reading material on the back. Literally dozens and dozens of books that are you can draw on. And then what you do to get going is join us on nightclub and do all the stuff that we do. The meditation thing sounds like Kunsang, Tibetan name. Maybe you're a meditator. Meditation is like the number one thing you can do to start really exploring these sorts of things. But if you're on and want to discuss further, more than welcome. Okay, here's a nice technical one from Lloyd. This one's very interesting. They're all interesting, but this one's cool. A bit longer, but it's worth reading. I've become a little bit aware of the role of dopamine in regard to the phenomena of wanting. During the course of this year, there seems to be an association between bipolar disorder and dopamine dysregulation. Also, Parkinson's disease is associated with a decline in dopamine production in the substantia nigra as this brain region experiences decay. And along with that, the individual becomes more and more apathetic. To go on a bit further, I have come across YouTube videos. Yes, whenever you get to, I'm going to say this tongue in cheek. Whenever you come across a YouTube video, it's got to be true, right? Be careful. It's not to say that they're not true. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying be careful. I've come across YouTube videos talking about dopamine detox. Okay, sounds good. Where one purposefully watches and lets go of craving. Yes, that's a really good thing to do. In your estimation, how much of working towards gaining freedom through spiritual technique is gaining mastery over the system versus working on other important goals? Okay, this is an interesting question. Well, you're talking about the difference between neurology and phenomenology. And so this is where, let me just say a couple things here. Yes, there are neural correlates, not to consciousness, but to metaconsciousness. There are neural correlates, not to consciousness, but to metaconsciousness. Well, that's not quite true. There are neural correlates to both. It's just that neuroscientists study the neural correlates to metaconsciousness, not the neural correlates to consciousness. And so what this means is that your question is dealing with what's called neurophenomenology, which is that whenever you have a particular experience, in this case, craving, desire, that's the phenomenology part. There's a neurological correlate to it. There's a brain thing going on, in this case, the dopamine gig. And this is actually very interesting. Let me toss this into the mix briefly. Bernardo said this the other day that I thought was just really pretty brilliant. I was listening to a riff on his, and he was talking about psychedelics and drugs and stuff. And he said something really interesting that just was so spot on. He said, you're on drugs right now. You're on drugs right now. You're on dopamine, you're on serotonin, you're on acetylcholine. You're on drugs right now. And so when you're doing something like acid or psilocybin or ayahuasca, yes, you're on drugs, but basically those are working with altering the biochemical and neural matrix of your brain, right? So this is actually a very interesting thing to look at. You are on drugs right now. So let's get back to the main topic, neurophenomenology. Yes, it's interesting to explore these sorts of things. I'm very interested in neurotransmitters and this whole neurological thing. But if you really want to gain mastery over the system, gain mastery over what you can work with directly. I mean, you know, most of us don't have the capacity. We don't have, unless you're in an fMRI or you have immediate neural feedback where you can get these sorts of things within a feedback even mechanism. So you have the information there. But fundamentally, if you want to gain freedom, is gain freedom over exactly what you're saying, is your craving mind. Read the book, Judson Brewer, I interviewed him 2 years ago, The Craving Mind. He's a MD, PhD, really great neuroscientist who's also a pretty serious practitioner. He talks a ton about this sort of thing. But in a very real way, a massive part of the spiritual meditative thing is in fact about establishing a relationship to this whole craving phenomena. And so when you do that, then all the neurological stuff that you're talking about is automatically altered, right? Because that's the neurological correlate of the transformation of those phenomenological states of mind. So, you know, unless you're on here, Lloyd, and want to follow up with this further, let me see if I'm missing anything. How much of working towards gaining freedom through spiritual practice is gaining mastery over this system? Yeah, I wouldn't, you know, again, that's the gaining mastery over the neurological correlate to this particular type of craving thing. In this regard, it's everything. It's huge. This connects to the question earlier about addiction. I mean, basically, where we are, we're all fundamentally addicts. And I think I shared the story with you when I went into my three-year retreat, which was phenomenally painful for me first 3 months. And I tried to figure out, why is it so hard to just sit in this room, you know, day after day after day? I felt like I was just being burned alive. And then I realized several weeks in, I realized, man, this is detox. I've never been addicted to classic substances. I just don't roll that way. That stuff has no interest in my life. But I realized maybe this is exactly what happens in detox. And I really felt that way. I was becoming detoxified from my addiction to craving altogether, from my substance abuse. I abuse the substance of thought. That's substance abuse. I abuse the substance of the phenomenal world. Form abuse. So we're all substance abusers. We're all addicts, whether we know it or not. And on one level, we have to cut ourselves a little slack because we live in the cosmological schema. We live in the domain of, literally, it's called the realm of desire. It's a euphemism. We live in the realm of addiction, craving. And so therefore, it's no surprise that we're all fundamentally addicts because we live in this world of addiction, craving. And so what you're talking about here, Lloyd, is going really deep into the primary issue of samsara, which is why we suffer, because we crave. So read Justin Brewer's book, listen to the podcast I did with him, and positively by working with craving, relating to it instead of from it, because relating from it is no relationship at all. This is how you will transform your mind and also this dopaminergic system, right? This is cool. I like this stuff.
Hey, Andrew.
Yo.
Amy has her hand up. Let me get her unmuted real quick. I think it might be her.
This is Lloyd. Does the question have to do with anything we're talking about right now?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Fire away.
Yes. Hello. This is Amy. I just wanted to put a personal anecdote in there. I have had bipolar disorder my whole life. And I've also been lucid just about my whole life, but I'm getting advanced now where I'm becoming more lucid during the day. And it's more continuous from day to night and night to day. And in fact, the mantra that I've made up for myself, I write it down in my journal, and that is aiding that sort of destructuring my bipolar emphasis. It's just falling away as any sort of identity for myself. Is I don't think about that anymore. I don't feel that way anymore. I'm much more just lucid in the now. Fantastic. And I just have to, I sent in a question. I hope you get to it, not to preempt anybody, but it relates. I've just had since May over 65 dreams of a wasp hive. A wasp hive, and I draw it, a wasp hive.
Okay.
And the hive is a container for my soul. There's no wasps in it, it's empty. And the hive itself is my layers of life experience. Beautiful. That is accrued, right? Beautiful. And and each dream, I have them every few days. It's like a lesson. It's like a guided tour into this lucid realm. And recently it's just escalated and gone very quickly. And I feel like I'm now up in the collective unconscious. So that was my question for you about what I do there. But anyway, the bipolar stuff has totally become deconstructed. I realize a ton of it was learned because it's built into the hierarchy of my family tree. And it's just fallen away as I've become more lucid, especially the day to night, night to day. Lucidity it's been amazing. Absolutely benefited me.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. And thank you for chiming in. And I will get to your question. It's like two or three down. And then you can come back on because you had some really interesting things to say about the collective unconscious, which I can get to. But a couple of things here, just to, I'll put an exclamation point. Spot on. Everything you say is spot on. And this whole notion of deconstruction is colossal. I mean, fundamentally, all our desires are based on constructs. The self sense of self is a construct. The sense of other is a construct. And you want to know, back to Lloyd's question, you want to know the fundamental mechanics of desire, want, is when we want, by definition, we want something other, right? Otherwise, we wouldn't want. If we had everything we wanted, we wouldn't want. So when you say want, by definition, it means other. And so basically, if you want to really solve the whole desire thing, deconstruct duality, deconstruct the self sense. And by totally deconstructing the sense of other, hey, guess what happens? You no longer want. You realize you already have everything that you want. In fact, here's another brief thing for you, Lloyd. And this is a really powerful contemplation. I say this all the time because it warrants reiteration all the time. Take a very, very, very close look at the mechanics, the phenomenology of desire, and see if the following is in fact not true. We think we're happy when we get what we want, and that's why we never stop wanting. That's why we're killing this planet and over-consuming and all the levels of epidemics of obesity and everything, you know, consuming. Because again, we live in this realm of deficiency, lack, where we feel we can only satiate that desire by filling ourselves from external agencies. That never leads to it because you're eating the menu instead of the meal. So take a very close look at desire. You think you're happy when you get what you want. No, you're really happy when you stop wanting. So we confuse the satisfaction of desire with its temporary transcendence. Let me say that again. This will save you $1 trillion if you have $1 trillion. We confuse the satisfaction of desire with its temporary transcendence. So just transcend craving, transcend desire by realizing you already have everything you could possibly want. And this is exactly what we spent a week in Mexico in the non-duality program talking about. You already have everything you could possibly want. You'll get rid of all your craving. You'll get rid of all your suffering. That's really what liberation is about. So you deconstruct all this exactly like Amy is talking about to get to these fundamental truths and principles. So thank you for that, Amy. And I'll get back to the rest of your sent in question in just a second, and you're welcome to come back on then. Okay. Awesome. Okay. From Katie, thank you very much for recommending the book Creation and Completion, Essential Points of Tantric Meditation. Yeah. So this is part of the thing that I ping out or Alyssa pings out on social media for me, recommended books. This book for the deeper divers. Oh my God, this book is beyond profound. For the deeper divers, I can't recommend this book too highly. Creation and Completion, The Essential Points of Tantric Meditation. I happen to have it right here because I gave a talk to Tergar about this book. This is an amazing book. I don't know how many times I've read it. The commentary on a seminal text by Jungkun Kontrol Lo Do Tai. I can't recommend this book too highly. Deep. It's not an easy read, but it's really profound. I read it and kept studying since then. Last week, Karagar Community offered a live oral transmission of this text and also of a white Tara Sadhana, both read by in Tibetan by Lama Trinle. Wonderful. Could you please unpack a little bit of the phenomena, the aim of oral transmission? Okay, sure. So this connects a little bit. Yeah, it's interesting. Some of these questions are really connected. This connects a little bit to the Abhishek of the Wong, the empowerment question earlier. And by this, what I mean is that when you get, there's again, so much to say here. If you go all the way to the top and get a full-blown empowerment, Abhishek, very often there's what's called a lung associated with that, or sometimes irrespective of that, there's what's called a reading transmission. So this is what Katie's question is about. And there's also a third aspect to this, which is called the tree, T-R-I in Tibetan, which is the commentary. So lung, wang, and tree are the T-R-I, are the three principal ways to kind of convey this kind of lineage, blessing, and transmission power. So basically, specifically, Katie, if you're here, what this refers to, the lung is a reading transmission that is basically a way to connect you all the way through a lineage of oral transmissions, all the way back to the origination of the sacred text that you're studying. In this case, the Tara Sadhana or the lung from the text of Jungkun Kontrol Lo Do Tai. And so what happens is there's, you know, the teacher, the master, whatever, reads it, that creates kind of the seed for this blessing power. Then whoever receives the lung, if they're qualified at a certain level, then they're able to distribute it themselves. And so fundamental, the notion here is to create a kind of electricity, a cord, electric cord, wireless transmission of energy going all the way back generation to generation to the very root essence of these texts that plugs you then into this lineage. And when you do it and you really stay open to it, you know, you're not distracted, you're not checking your watch, you're not like doing whatever. You're 100% present, you're really listening. It's a 220 volt plug-in to the lineage that brings about this entire transmission thing. And so that's the principal reason the phenomenon of lung is in fact really that. I wouldn't say as simple as that because that's not simple, but it's actually very profound. That fundamentally you're kind of connecting to the electricity of the transmission of this lineage going back to the very beginning. And there's a lot to be said about the power of lineage. It's the closest you're going to get to a guarantee that a tradition is legit, that it's working, that there's some authenticity here. And the Tibetans take this stuff very seriously. They don't confer lungs randomly, so they certainly don't do wangs and abhishekas randomly, but it's all somewhat in the, especially lungs and wangs, W-A-N-G, abhishekas are somewhat in the same stream of the power of connecting to lineage going back all the way to the root source. So if you're here and want to ask more about that, I think that's probably enough. I participated, but can't figure out what really happened. Sometimes you don't have to really figure out what happened, just feel. Notice what you experience. I don't understand Tibetan, but now there's a strange feeling, that's good, that somehow these vocals and consonants are in my body. Yes, they are. And in a certain way, they've been stimulated, woken up. So when you do it like a full-blown empowerment, on one level, you can think of the empowerment as being somehow conferred from an external agency. The Kala Chakra, for instance, if you're doing a Kala Chakra empowerment, the external Kala Chakra somehow then comes and does his external agency thing. But just as importantly is when you do something like that, the Kala Chakra within you is aroused, stimulated, awakened. So it empowers the Kala Chakra within you. And so in a real way, something similar happens to the reading transmissions with texts like this, lungs, where it jogs your memory. Because on one level, you're already Buddha, you just forgot. You're already Kala Chakra, you just forgot. You're already Tara, in the 24 manifestations of that Tara, but you just forgot. And so Wang Lung Tree, all these things are designed to shake your memory, to wake you up and activate these seeds within you. And so that's one reason we do these things, because these seeds are latent within us and we activate them and then they start to grow. And you may notice I've done this, you do an empowerment, you do it seriously, and then certain very interesting magical sorts of things start to change for you. So these things are not social constructs. They're not designed for entertainment. They're very, very profound. So anyway, Katie, if you're on, that's what comes to mind. Okay, let me get Mary's and then I'll come back to Amy's. I'm listening to the recordings of your Pearlands 2 course. Thank you. As I was sadly unable to attend live. And so I was unable to ask a question about Sukhavati and Poa. For those of you who are not Tibetan, I apologize. There's a lot of great Tibetan questions here today. This is a little bit on the unusual side of things, but hey, so what? So I was unable to ask questions about Sukhavati, the pure land of Amitabha, and Poa. Poa is what's called ejection of consciousness practice during the retreat. I received Heruka Vajrayogini empowerment. There's another empowerment thing. What is it today? Deities and empowerments today. I received Heruka Vajrayogini empowerments. Again, these are two more fundamental archetypal entities. Now we can add them both to Kala Chakra, both to Tara. I mean, there's literally hundreds of these because there's hundreds of these energetics archetypes within you. I receive these empowerments and practice these sadhanas and visualizations. Good for you. Their pure land is Kiraja. I'm confused. I'm never sure how to pronounce this one. Kedra. I'm confused about where I should hope to go when I die. Oh, I chuckle, Mary, because these are just really great questions. I'm confused about where I should go when I die. Sukhavati Amitabha or Heruka Vajrayogini's pure land? Hey, if you can get to either one, I wouldn't worry. If you can get to either one, you're in great shape. So here's the deal. Here's why Sukhavati. Sukhavati is the easiest, and just because it's easy doesn't mean it's less powerful, right? Sukhavati has the easiest visa access. This Pure Land, in a certain sense, quote unquote, was designed for the general public. Anybody who does these practices with a concerted effort, studies the Pure Land material, does the practices, does the aspiration prayers, recites the mantra, etc., has a really pretty strong shot of being reborn after they die, if you believe in this sort of thing, in the most accessible of all Pure Land, Sukhavati. So who am I to say that you should go there versus, Heruka Vajrayogini's Pure Land? I can't tell you that. This is something you need to ask your teacher. If you have a connection to whoever gave you this empowerment and you're doing the sadhana, you need to ask them. I'm in no position to say you should do one or the other. But generally, the other pure lands, of which every Buddha has their own pure land. So all the ones I was talking about earlier, Ratnasambhava, Akshobhya, Moggachari, Amitabha, Vairochana, and dozens of others, all these supreme Buddhas, they have their own pure lands. But the general visa requirement for most of these is first bhumi, which is, that's not easy. To actually attain the path of seeing the first bhumi, again, sorry for those of you who don't know the whole Tibetan thing here, it's just a little bit too much to unpack. Unless you have that level of realization, which is not easy, you're not going to get to these pure lands. Sukhavati, it's easier to cross into this. So I would say as a general default, that's where you want to go. But I am in no position or authority to say that's where you should go because you're doing this other sadhana. You need to ask your teacher. Okay, I remember you taught that once one achieves rebirth in Sukhavati, one needs never return to as a human unless one chooses to do so as a bodhisattva. Yes, that's what they say. Makes sense to me. I've also learned that Heruka's Pure Land is a pure land for more advanced spiritual education. If you've heard that, then I'm not going to contest it. So, of course, I'd like to go there. Okay, then you should go there. But as far as I can tell, Poa practice, ejection of consciousness is only associated with Amitabha, Avalokiteshvara, and Sukhavati. No, that's not true. Poa practice, you can have a Poa practice with any of these Pure Lands. And again, talk to your teacher about this. But fundamentally, the way I was trained is one of the characteristics of where you're going to go. Again, I'm just going to tell you what I learned, is that instead of visualizing Amitabha on top of your head and reciting his mantra when you're doing what's called Nirmanakaya Poa, you visualize Heruka Vajrayogini on top of your head, or whatever Buddha, archetypal Buddha of the Pure Land you want to go to. You recite their mantra, and then you affect Poa that way. So my understanding is Poa is not just associated with Amitabha. Absolutely not. At least that's the way I was trained. If you can clarify this, I'd be even more grateful than I already am for your teachings. Thank you so much. Mary, that's what comes to mind. Okay. Well, that's a great question today. Goodness, we're going to be here till 6 o'clock. Okay. So here's, I'm going to come back to, hope these aren't too fast. Here's Amy's. Okay, Amy, back to yours. After being greeted by the collective unconscious in recent dreams, good for you. Draw what I see there, see drawings and posts on the dream journal board. I did see some of those, Amy. They're beautiful. Thank you for sharing those. High five. I'm wondering what to do when I'm in that shared space. What comes after the greeting? What should I be looking for? What actions make sense? I'm in awe of what I'm experiencing. Are there teachings or techniques I should be learning from about this? Okay. Great question. Well, I mean, first of all, here's the deal with, now we're going to be a little bit into psychology, in particular depth psychology, because collective unconscious is fundamentally associated with the depth psychology of Carl Jung. This guy was a bloody genius, right? And what can I say? It's absolutely brilliant. But, you know, the collective unconscious is as powerful as it is to access that. I wouldn't get stuck there. And this doesn't in any way dismiss what you're doing and what you're exploring. I mean, it's fantastic that you're actually able to do these sorts of things. It's really, really great. But it's still the collective unconscious shared by samsaric dimensions of being. It's still associated with certain levels of the eighth consciousness. So yes, you can explore it. You can do it if you want to, you know, explore this in a more classical sense. Read the work of Carl Jung, explore his teachings on the collective unconscious and how to work with archetypes in that sense. It's really, really powerful. But the spiritual gig transcends but includes that. It goes deeper, in my opinion. As powerful as Jung was, it's really interesting because Jung criticized Freud, went deeper, which is right on. He had a certain running familiarity with spirituality. In fact, he wrote the introduction to the first translation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which he saw and interpreted in a psychological fashion. That's a very interesting, somewhat tricky thing to do. And what I mean by that is, because he didn't have the reference points to, and again, I'm just projecting my understanding, because perhaps he didn't have the reference points to understand what the Tibetan Book of the Dead was really about, he had no choice but to download or translate it using the structures and mechanisms of his own mind. And therefore, was he giving an accurate rendering with the psychological interpretation? Not so sure. But because this is a really big topic and I want to get to some of the written questions and live ones,
Let me finish. Okay.
So what I would recommend, if you want to really go into this, is I would recommend, after you explore, you know, you're working with a kind of translational domain, I would work more with transformation. I would actually work to try to go deeper to the ninth consciousness, to something that's actually subsends even the collective unconscious, which is the collective superconscious mind. Clear light mind. So I'm not dissing what you're doing at all. It's fantastic. It's great. But at a certain point, it's going to bottom out, so to speak, because you're still in samsara. You're still just moving deck chairs on the Titanic. Not a criticism, just situating it within a larger, perhaps, framework of the spiritual vectors, which would include explorations of the super unconscious mind, which would be the clear light mind. So anyway, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I just wanted.
That's okay. I didn't mean to cut you off either. But since I submitted that question for today, I've had additional dreams because I've asked specifically, I've asked myself, like, what's above the collective unconscious? Because I was sort of simmering in that space. Right. And I was shown that my high was on a ladder. And can you see that? The ladder. ascends out of the collective unconscious, and I'm up at the top of that ladder in another space.
Oh, cool.
See what I mean?
Yeah. Nice. Cool.
So I think I'm where what you're talking about.
Yeah. Beautiful. You know, I might just, this may or may not be of any interest to you. I would say don't go higher. I'd say go lower.
Oh, okay.
By that, what I mean is I actually prefer metaphors that are subsending, not transcending.
Yeah.
And by that, it just speaks to me a little bit more that basically, if you look at the collective unconsciousness as germinative of the expressions of the archetypes as they manifest in physical reality, you can go something that's even more germinative than that. You can go lower than that, right? And therefore, you can get below the stem cell to the very nature of the whole shebang. So I actually find switching the metaphors, the ladder should be going down. No, I shouldn't say should. Consider the ladder, maybe the ladder to go down below. And so otherwise there's this escapist tendency, possibly this transcendentalism that can become somewhat interesting and potentially problematic. So again, it's called depth psychology, not height psychology. So depth psychology into depth spirituality. I would just go as deep as you possibly can.
I like that. Yeah. Okay.
That would be good. And then really just maybe familiarize yourself if you want some doctrinal infrastructure for this. The Yogacara, read the literature on the eight consciousnesses. And there's a vast repertoire there. Thich Nhat Hanh wrote a beautiful book called Understanding Our Mind, or Understanding Your Mind. That's a really great text, the work of Carl Brunholzl. He's got about 4 or 5 volumes on the Yogacara. This is really interesting to understand because it'll go below what Jung was talking about into deeper dimensions of being. So that's what comes to mind.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your offering. Really cool stuff.
Thanks.
Okay, so let me see what's in the chat and if there's anybody here that wants to raise their hand. Oh, Tendril, right. Okay, hold on here. From Tim, the other night I had a dream that I was out in class on the nature of change and impermanence. There was a middle-aged Asian man with glasses there. After I woke up, I realized it was Trungpa Rinpoche. Look at the photo. Definitely was him. In your opinion, is there some spiritual significance when we dream of a spiritual teacher or master like this? There always is. I can't say exactly, Tim, what it means for you. Dreams of clarity, right? Whenever you can have a dream of a teacher, master, deity, or whatever, it's always significant. The specificity of the significance, I can't address with you. That would be more like a dream interpretation thing. And this is not quite the right forum for that sort of thing. But anytime you have this sort of thing, it's an indication of the purification of karma. We talked about that earlier, that your unconscious mind is basically spending more and more time with spiritual and higher so-called or lower, depending on what metaphor you want to use, ideals. And therefore, it starts to manifest in your dream. So very, very cool. The specifics I can't say, but definitely cool. Okay. All right. Jerry, could you have Alyssa spell the mantra that went something like Om Mani Mamba?
It was the one that he repeated like 12,000 times that he was after.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Om Vajrasattva Home. Sorry. That's the only one I repeated. Om. They almost all start with Om. They almost all end in Hum. Vajra, V-A-J-R-A. Sattva, S-A-T-T-V-A. Om Vajrasattva Home. It's the short version of the classic 100-syllable mantra, which I won't spell out, which is the archetypal. Vajrasattva is like a super deity. He's like the king of all the Sambhogakaya deities, Jerry. He's associated with the Ein Sof in Jewish mysticism, the basic goodness, Shiva Ukkur in Shambhala, Dharmakaya in Buddhism. So Vajrasattva is a really unique special deity. It's like the archetype of all the deities. And so that's why his particular mantra has so much power. I need to excuse myself for 1 minute because I'm expecting someone to clean my dryer ducts and my dog is barking like crazy and I have to make sure he's not here. So I'll be right back. Okay, all good. Sorry. Okay. And my new computer glasses. They really help. Okay. All right. So, oh yeah, George, fire away. There's a couple live ones. Fire away.
Hey, Andrew. How are you doing? Hey,
I'm good, man. How are you?
Doing fine. Thanks. Thanks. I would like to share two short points today. Because you might or might not remember, a couple months ago on Q&A, you and I asked you a question, and we discussed on the thought of the possibility of integrating RIGPA during a lucid dream, basically integrating the dream images with RIGPA in a lucid dream. And I think one of your comments saying that that this is not so much talked about in the teachings. And I actually had the opportunity to ask a couple of geishas actually in the last couple of months exactly on this question. I wanted to share what they said.
Tenzin Wangyal does talk about it a little bit when he talks about clear light dreams. Also, just parenthetically, and then I'll stop and you can run with it. This is actually exactly the fruition I mentioned in the book earlier from Katie's question, creation and completion. The union of creation and completion is what actually creates these type of clear light dreams. So that's also connected to that massive, beautiful book by Jungmun Kontrol Lodur Thai. But in that book, he doesn't really talk about dreams in this regard. So I'm very interested to see what he said.
Well, actually, they didn't say much, actually. I asked the first geisha, and basically just looked at me for 5 seconds, like I don't know, probably, I thought like a kindergarten kid would ask him about higher mathematics. And he just said, it's very advanced. And then the next different geisha during a public talk asked the same question, and he said the same, it's very advanced. But it's the ultimate fruition. So that's exactly what you said just now. And that was beautiful to hear that, and it also opened up or made clear that there's such a long way to go with that. I mean,
yes, it's the most advanced form of dreaming until dreaming stops altogether. So I completely agree. And really, for those who are interested in this, the way to actually grease the skids for that type of dream is to work with the union of generation and completion stage meditations. That's how you do it. And then when they are actually brought into union, then a consequence, and it's also one way that they've been brought into union, is because you start having dreams like this. So yeah, very cool. That's really awesome, man.
Second gem, actually, very, very quickly. So I followed up on the question with a third geisha. I was lucky. I had the opportunity to ask. And I asked him, geisha La, I mean, when I'm sitting on the cushion and I'm in RIGPA, it's a different experience than being lucid in a dream and seeing dream images. I don't feel the same. The RIGPA quality is not strong, or it's not the same experience, not the same quality. And he just answered, or he said in one sentence, and he didn't say much more about that, but he said, your dream, so I asked him, I have to specify. So I basically said, so I feel that I'm not in RIGPA, even if I'm lucid in a dream and see those dream images and interact and so on. So he said to me, and that really shook me, he said, those dream images are your RIGPA.
That's correct. That's when they're seen in union with generation. So, exactly. What can I say? It's spot on. But let me just say one little thing here and see if this lands with you. It's very subtle, but it's important because when you start talking at this level, this really super refined non-dualistic level, language becomes pretty problematic. So when people say, and again, I'm not being accusatory. Hopefully what I'm saying might be revelatory. You can't actually say I'm in Rigpa because those terms are mutually exclusive. You cannot be in Rigpa. Rigpa is actualized when you are gone. So you might actually have, and that's one way you know that you're having Rigpa experiences because there's no you. And so when you come back out of it, yes, retrospectively, because that's resting in the union of generation and completion. Initially, it's usually completion stage only, by the way. That's the pointing out the Dharmakaya aspect of it. It's only when you come out and look back on it that you can say, hey, I was in Rigpa. But when you're in Rigpa, you can't say that. You can't say anything because there is no you. At that point, you are Tat Tvam Asi. You become Rigpa. So this may seem nitpicking, but it's not. It's actually quite important. But good for you. I mean, to have access to three geishas like that. Man,
that's right. Yeah, no, absolutely. Just one more comment. As it's totally different for me being lucid in a dream and not feeling that I'm in Rigpa. So that's clearly for me in the lucid. I'm lucid in the dream. Yeah. Or might be lucid in a lucid dream, basically, seeing the images, but it's not Rigpa. So right. with that answer, saying basically that the dream images, are Rigpa. That basically, as I said, it shook me and basically sent me back to the cushion, actually, in order to be able to integrate that maybe in the waking state more with the mind images or mind appearances coming up during regular practice on the cushion. So slowly moving it, maybe. Yeah, okay, I can't really explain that now. But do you get what I'm saying, basically?
It's
a rift, between daytime practice in nighttime practice, even though I'm lucid, the connection to Rigpa was not there. You know,
until you're really high, until you're pretty high on the boomies, there's going to be a rift. That's what constitutes the path, is developing greater accessibility to Rigpa until fundamentally there's no difference. So don't beat yourself up about it. This is just part of what's involved with increased stability in the day and at night. And so it's really exactly like the Geshe said, you know, when you realize. It's also connected, by the way, to the perfectly pure illusory form. So this is another set of practices. And if you look at my book, Dreams of Light, I have several chapters where I talk exactly about this thing. Yeah. But until we can realize the display, in this case, the display is the appearance of images in the dream, until we can actually recognize those as the rupakayas, as the display of Rigpa, we're still separating out generation and completion, and therefore you're not having a clear light dream. But the way you work with it is exactly what you're doing. You know, you just continue to stabilize your meditation, increase your stabilization of the recognition of Rigpa. But it's also very subtle trap. Don't get stuck in the Dharmakaya, because Rigpa is the unity of the Trikaya, and very often people just get stuck in the Dharmakaya. No, this is one reason why you can't make that union yet of you and the appearance, because you're still separating out the Rupakayas from the Dharmakaya, see? And so you want to be able to integrate all three kayas, otherwise you're still very, very subtly, I wouldn't say stuck, but very, very subtly working with this path of integration. But this is pretty cool. It's subtle advanced stuff, but you're obviously talking to some amazing people that can help you. So high five. That's awesome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for everything they gave. Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate it. Good stuff. Okay. So EKP 0506.
I need to change my Zoom ID. Yeah,
it looks like some serial number thing right here.
Yeah, my work ID. So you mentioned this book and that you're going to be speaking with this author. I found this book very difficult, but it's what got me started on my journey into lucid dreams. So did you say you're interviewing him for your podcast, or what's your association? Yeah.
Well, I endorsed the book. He asked me to endorse his book. He interviewed me a couple of years ago and he was doing some stuff. Tenzin Wangyal, I love this guy. He's amazing. And I read that book when it first came out, like how many decades ago now? And so the new edition, second edition came out. I endorsed it. And so I'm going to be interviewing him on Tuesday.
We're going to be talking. Oh, good. So that'll be on your podcast?
Yes.
Great. Yep. Yeah. And then I had a question. So I'm reading your Dreams of Light, and I guess my question is, you know, I'll read your teachings on emptiness, and this, the chapter on the science of emptiness, you know, it just blows your mind. It's like how every atom is empty, and ultimately, you know, the universe is empty and things moving at the speed of light. And, but I, in the moment when I'm reading it, your teachings or any teachings, like, I get it. Gosh, I understand emptiness, and, or I understand the Heart Sutra. And then an hour later, I'm back to being petty, worried about stupid things. I forget it. And so how do you work with this? I guess it's just our human inability to keep the teachings and to forget. And it makes so much sense. And then it's gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Great question. Yes. That's the difference between experience and realization. So you basically, we, as we go through the path, we go through three general phases. They don't have to be necessarily in order, but it does help. First phase, in a certain way, is understanding. That's kind of what you do when you read and you study, and you know what we're doing here is I'm flapping my lips and maybe something of value is sticking and you're understanding certain things. At a certain point, the understanding will give way to experience, where you have exactly what you said. You have an experience of emptiness. But experience by definition is like mist. It doesn't last. And that's fine. I mean, just the fact that you've had an experience is really quite okay. Then really what happens, that's a brief glimpse of what I just very quickly shot out earlier about the path of seeing. So the path of seeing, basically third phase of five phases of one path. It's not like five different paths, but the path of seeing is exactly that path when you first experience emptiness reality. And then because of the power of habit, there's habit again, right? Karma, your bad habits kick back in and the light goes back off and then you forget, you lose it. So the essence of spiritual practice, the Vajrayana said this is beautiful. The essence of spiritual practice is remembrance. We forget for dozens of reasons. The forgetfulness manifests in distraction. It manifests in non-lucid dreams. And look at your mind, how often you're distracted. That's a moment of forgetfulness. So then really the practice becomes one of increased memory, increased remembrance. And that when that memory is stabilized, which takes a little bit of time, that journey in Buddhist language is the journey from the first to the 10th bhumi, the 10 levels, then you attain the stage of realization, and that's basically full awakening. So don't worry that the light comes on, comes back off. I mean, how did Houston Smith put it, the religious scholar? Beautiful line, the process of the path is to transform flashes of illumination into abiding light. That's just what the path is about. So we all have, not we all, people who are interested have these glimpses, but for many, many reasons, they're just not stable. Too many bad habits. We still fall into the habits that we've constructed. And so the way you proceed is with a sense of understanding. See, so now you retrofit your experience with this understanding. And you approach everything with a sense of levity, playfulness, lightheartedness. And don't try, it's very interesting, don't try too hard. In fact, I would say don't try at all to recreate the experience, because the experience is actually brought about by quality of openness. And so this also ties in, it gets really subtle with this business. It ties into this earlier question about desire and wanting. Well, if you want too much to reestablish that experience of emptiness, well, guess what happens? That's still a subtle form of craving. Now you're just craving for spiritual experience. You become a state junkie, or what my friend Zvi calls a God addict. You just become addicted to that. So it gets really slippery. So the way to do it is you let go of even that. You let go of everything. That's real emptiness, self-liberate, the emptiness of emptiness. You let go of everything. And the more you do that, the more, guess what happens? The more you let go, open, let go. Well, guess what happens? The more the light keeps coming on. And so that's the whole delightful, tortuous thing we call the path, right? And so patience, humor, levity, proper understanding. So you just joke at the whole thing. And also determination, perseverance, and endurance. I mean, I did my three-year retreat at a place called Supacholing, which means Dharma, place of patience or forbearance, endurance, where you just keep going. And then eventually, because you're doing something that's in resonance with reality, it actually becomes easier. It's a lot easier to wake up than it is to fall asleep. That's the really good news. And when you die, this is really good news. When you die, these glimpses become extremely powerful because that's what's going to be revealed. The full light of this will be revealed at the moment of death. What you're experiencing is what's called the child luminosity. At the moment of death, the child will recognize the mother. That's called the mother and child luminosity in reunion. And that's enlightenment. And so these small little glimpses are no small thing. Learning how to relate to them, understand them, is also really helpful. So we celebrate, but then we release. And then we just continue. You forget. But you might find you're remembering more and more and more because the glimpse of emptiness is a glimpse of the natural state. And because it is natural, it actually becomes more and more natural the more you just hang with it, so to speak. Okay?
Very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, welcome. Good stuff. Good question. Okay, maybe two more. Oh, actually, I got a minute. What time did we stop? Oh, yeah, we got a few. Okay. Pramdas, fire away, bud. Hello? Unmute.
Yes, sir. I had a meditation question. The practice of shamatha, when the mind drifts into discursive thought, you know, the advice is to return to breath and body. But of course, if that becomes so much of a crutch, then because, you know, again, but the body itself is a thought, is a mental construct.
Right.
So how does one start to let go of even that, or if you have any, you know, because ultimately, you know, going toward the path of seeing.
Great question, Pramdas. Yeah, this is a great one. This is precisely the transition from referential to non-referential practices. And the way to do it is through practice and increased familiarity with non-referential shamatha, shamatha with, I'll give you six names for the same thing, and then I'll land with a name that I use the most. Non-referential shamatha, formless shamatha, shamatha without a sign, objectless shamatha, or my favorite, open awareness. Learn more about open awareness. I riff on this. This is like one of my main practice riffs these days. That's the way you make that transition, because you're right. The body is as important as it is. It's just a hitching post. It's an anchor. At a certain point, you can pull the hitching post out. You don't need it. In fact, at a certain point, that hitching post becomes problematic, because the best that can do is bring about a state of tranquility. Shamatha will not get you enlightened. Shamatha pacifies. It doesn't liberate. And so as powerful as shamatha is, you can get stuck, as Milarepa said, you can get stuck in shamatha's pool. It becomes so tranquil, so blissful. This is where the traps of the jhana states come in. The jhana states are fantastic. They're brilliant. I mean, all the stuff I talked about with Delson Armstrong, amazing stuff. I'm not dissing that in the slightest. And he's a master with this stuff. But these are still at the level of shamatha, just super refined shamatha. In fact, you can attain qualities, what's called supra mundane shamatha, where you can get stuck in these refined states for a very, very long time. So in order to make this transition, you put a crowbar, and that's not the right image. You transition away, transcend, but include, that's important, transcend, but include your referential meditations using body, breath, candle, mantra, whatever, any referent, any form. And you transition into the formless meditations, in particular, open awareness. This is the genius transitional practice from form to full-blown Rigpa. So for those who really want to develop this transition, we're talking, George, about Rigpa. You know, when Rigpa degenerates, it degenerates into open awareness. So you can therefore use open awareness as breadcrumbs. It leaves breadcrumbs. You can follow your way back into Rigpa by using the practice of open awareness. And so Pramdas, that's where I would work with, play with. It's an incredibly powerful practice that I'm riffing on more and more these days, because the more I do it, the more I realize it's great gifts and it's great contribution.
Do you make a distinction between open awareness and nature of mind?
Yes, I do. Yeah, open awareness is still not nature of mind. Again, nature of mind, Rigpa, same. when nature mind rigpa degenerates, like you're in samadhi, you're hanging out in that space, which is quite lovely. Well, again, somewhat in connection to the serial number question. Sorry, I didn't get the name. it's gonna collapse because it's not stable. It's just not stable. When it collapses and degenerates, so to speak, it degenerates into open awareness. So open awareness is not nature of mind, but it's about the closest I know of, outside of other practices that are beyond our scope right now, that people can use to work their way in. Because if you do open awareness to full fruition, it actually transitions into nature of mind. See? So that it's a genius practice. It's like unbelievable. Mingyur Rinpoche teaches this a ton. And now I see why. And I teach it a ton because it's just so powerful. Thank you. If you don't know about it, look into it, because that's what you're looking for.
Thank you.
Okay, bud. Okay, Jerry. Fire away, Dr. G. I guess it's Dr. J, right? Dr. J.
You know, I've mentioned this before, but and I've looked and I've searched, but I've only found one person in this whole area, southeastern Michigan, who knows anything about anything but, you know, the Western style of, you know, go for what you want and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You wrote an essay, I think, once on contemplation.
Me? Yes, I did.
And I'd like to download that and read it. If you could put it in the chat column or something, you know how to do that.
You know, you can find it several places, Jerry. I published it. I didn't publish it. Tricycle published it. So if you look, I think it's called The Lost Art of Contemplation.
I'm not sure because I was moving and somehow I printed it and then lost it.
Oh, the actual document that I had. Yeah, I'd have to pull that out. It's in a folder somewhere. But what I'm saying is that until I do that, which I can, if Alyssa reminds me, I can have that up for us next time. Until I do that, Tricycle published it in a slightly abridged form. You'll find it there. But my whole 10-page point thing, I have to pull it out of a folder. I can't do that right now.
And the other thing is, you know, the first experience I've had with meditation was transcendental meditation. But, you know, since nobody else did it or any other type, I fell away from it. Yeah. I have had many, let's say, amazing experiences, but, you know, no one to back me up. Are you offering a course online about meditation?
Let me think here for a second. I'm doing a Rolodex of all the things I have coming up over the next 8 months. I'm doing a program for Tricycle on reverse meditation, like classic standard meditation.
I don't have any teachers. I don't have anyone to go to know if I'm doing it right or wrong.
Oh, here we go. Well, here's what, there's two things you can do. You live in Southwest Michigan. Do you know about Jewel Heart in
Ann Arbor? Southeastern Michigan, just north of Detroit.
Yeah, do you know about Jewel Heart in Ann Arbor? It used to be Gaelic Rinpoche Center. He died, but it's still there. Check them out.
Okay.
Yeah, they're in Ann Arbor. I'm pretty sure they're still in Ann Arbor. Jewel Heart.
Jewel Heart?
Yeah, it's Gaelic Rinpoche scene. He was a beautiful Gelugpa, who I'm pretty darn sure that center is still there. He's in
there. Right. And the other thing is you mentioned earlier, you know, all those mantras, and one of them was something like "Oh, mommy." Could you, you know, like put in the chat column, you know, the spelling of that? And do you say that during the day, or do you say that as you're going to sleep? Or
if they give me a little, I spit out several rather quickly. The only one that I mentioned earlier when it came up in the chat was Om Vajrasattva Hum. It's the only one I said more than once. I mean, there's so many, Jerry. Are you looking for like a particular mantra that you can establish a relationship with? Is that kind of what you're thinking?
Well sure. Like, how about, I heard there's a mantra you should say before you go to sleep, for example.
Oh, that one. Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah. Om Amidewa Hri. I'll spell it for you. Om. O-M.
Yep.
Ami, A-M-D, A-M-I. I'm sorry. Ami, A-M-I.
Uh-huh.
Dewa, D-E-W-A, Om Ami Dewa Hri, H-R-I-H, Om Ami Dewa Hri.
H-R-I-H.
Yeah, Om Ami Dewa Hri.
It's and also saying that over and over as you're going to sleep, or?
Beautiful thing, yeah. There's a number that you can do just as you're going to sleep, but that's a really good one because that's the Tibetan version of Amitabha's mantra. So that will help you, again, FedEx your consciousness to his Pure Land, Sukhavati. So that's a really powerful mantra to have during any moment of transition. Om Amidewa Hri. So I do it every night.
Should you say it during the day too, when you have time?
No, here's the deal with these mantras, my friend. Say them as much as you possibly can. Okay. You want to get to the point. Here's the deal. We are always reciting, and again, I say this with mantra quote unquote here because it's not a real mantra. But we say samsaric mantras all the time. And usually they're in some version of me, 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 me. Or if you don't like that one, I, ay, 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 ay. Or if you don't like that one, mind, 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 mind. I mean, we're reciting some version. These are called seed syllable mantras. Look at your mind. We're reciting some version of these samsaric mantras all the time. That's a really bad habit, right?
Yes.
We want to transform that habit into a good habit. And so I do this. I mean, I recite mantras, I wouldn't say 24/7, but whenever I remember, again, especially in motion, when I'm traveling, when a situation is going to stretch me, test me, I'm going to lose my seat kind of thing, I am always reciting mantras. And you want to do that because eventually at a certain point, in a certain way, the mantra starts to recite you. The mantra starts to do you. That's when you know, in a certain sense, you've somewhat accomplished the mantra, because then instead of CNN and the subcrawler right, running through your mind is different layers of samsara. Yeah. No, you've got deities going through your mind, you know? And I mean, I love classical music. So usually I have Chopin or Beethoven running through my mind. That's not too bad. But you know, it's not quite the same as having a mantra running through my mind. And so the point here, my friend, and again, I say this with complete seriousness, try to get into the habit where you're reciting these things all the time. Because then what happens is, hey, wait a second. You know, then my mind is taking a kind of voluntary rebirth into the sound. These are sounds of the awakened mind. And so if you can recite these as much as, I mean, it's a core aspect of all the Pure Land teachings, get into the habit, good habit of reciting these things constantly. And it will change your life, man. You'll start to have visions of Amitabha or whatever. You'll start to have, they'll appear in your dreams. It's no small thing. And so over the last couple of years, ever since, I mean, it triggered me when I read Kulbi Chaudhary's book, Sound Medicine. I interviewed here like 2 years ago. I started doing a much deeper new dive into the power of mantra. And I read the teachings from Kashmir Shaivism on the doctrine of vibration. And so I've developed a much deeper, more refined appreciation and I think understanding of the power of mantra. I mean, the world is made of sound, for God's sakes, right? Think of string theory, you know, quantum field theory. It's just basically membranes and vibration, and particles are just nodes. Everything is, I mean, there's something about the New Age thing. Everything is vibration. It really is. And so you want good vibrations, right? And so, you know, the ultimate mantra is silence. Silence is the sound of God, right? But if you can't remain in Rigpa, ultimate silence, then you recite a mantra. That's Sambhogakaya level. So to whatever extent you can, get these things into your system and recite them all the time.
So the one you just said is Om, I was trying to write it down, Om Ami.
Dewa.
Dewa Hri.
Hri, yeah, Hri. It's got a little Hebrew. Hri. Hri.
Om Ami Dewa Hri. Om Ami Dewa Hri. Is that the way it goes?
Yeah. Again, there's so many. Om Mani Padme Hum is great. There's so many, but you asked specifically about what to recite when you're going to sleep.
Yeah.
During any moment of transition, Amitabha's mantra is really up there, really powerful.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and you'll find, Jerry, the more you do it, the more you connect to it. I mean, really, these practices are genius. I mean, they take on their own power. This is mantra is the first wireless communication system, right? These things are beyond profound. And they're derived by great siddhas, rishis, masters who are exquisite listeners. You know, they, like with Prem Das's question, they're so quiet, they're so still, they're so pacified with shamatha that they can hear, they can hack into the vibratory code of reality. And then they come up and they upload their through this extraordinary auditory capacity, inner ear, these vibrations, which are the sound of the awakened mind. And then by reciting them, you're changing your subtle body configuration. You're actually, you're working with reconfiguring your nadi system. You're invoking a kind of resonance. Mantras are incredibly powerful agents. So to whatever extent you can make a connection, do it. They're awesome, man. And then in terms of meditation, I was thinking, in terms of meditation stuff, if you're a nightclub member, I can't remember.
Yeah, again, I am.
Go back to the early, somewhere in the meditation series things. I think also, I'm just trying to remember. I think it's also in the webinar series. I probably did 3, 4, 5, 6 different talks about shamatha. And if you listen to those early webinars and track them down, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head. Pretty darn sure I spent a fair amount of time with this because this is ultimate lucidity practice, right?
So was that at the very beginning of
way back. Yeah, way back, 3 years.
Way back. Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Anybody else? Or are we good for today? Am I missing anything? If we're good, it looks like we might be. Does anyone know the website that lists and explains the main gods and goddesses in Buddhism? Oh, Lordy. Website-wise, no, but there's a hell of a lot of books on these. Website-wise, I don't really know. Oh, yeah, nice job, Alyssa. Yeah, Amitabha thing, that's great. What does it mean? Mantras don't have to have meanings. The power of a mantra comes from a sonics of power. Mantras are sometimes, yes, they have translations like Om Mani Padme Hum, Hail the Jewel in the Lotus. Om Mani Devahi. I mean, Om, associated with the head chakra. Ami, Dewa, Ami means deathless. Dewa means bliss. It's connected to Amitabha. So basically, honestly, in a very playful way, but somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but somewhat real, this is Amitabha's email address. You want to FedEx your consciousness into his mind? This is how you do it, mixing three metaphors. Om Ami Dewa Hri, this is his text, this is his email address. This is how you get to him. And where is he, of course? Where's the ultimate Amitabha? Where's the ultimate Sukhavati, Pure Land? Right here. Always remember, the ultimate mantra is within you, the ultimate Pure Land is within you. So if you really want to recite the ultimate mantra, remain in absolute silence. That's the ultimate mantra. And then you'll hear everything you need to hear, right? Hey, everybody, nice to see you. So what we do here, if you're into it, we do this little dedication of merit, always to remind ourselves of what we're doing. It's not just for us, because if you take a very close look, right, there isn't one. We don't exist. We appear. Yes, we're here. We appear and we're waving and you're listening to this goof brain over here spew his whatever. Yes, but fundamentally, we don't exist. So remember, whatever we do to discover this egolessness, selflessness, and then we gather all this merit and we send it out, send it to all the people that are in such need right now, and there's a lot. So we don't appropriate the little goodies for ourselves. We're doing this. If you really want to accelerate your path, my teacher Kempo Rinpoche said this. He said, it's really, really, really hard to accelerate your path. Karma has to work its way out on its own terms. However, he said, there's one thing that can accelerate your path if you walk it for the benefit of others, the bodhisattva ideal. So if you really want to put the accelerator on your meditation and your spiritual path, do it for others. Don't do it for yourself. And so with that spirit, we gather everything, send it out across the world. If you want to unmute and say hi, bye, always a fun geeky thing to do. Otherwise, dream sharing thing tomorrow. I think I'm on Monday. We got a bunch of stuff coming up. I'll see you in the hood, so to speak. Thanks, everybody. Talk to
you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.